From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. A UN agency report issued Tuesday predicts that what it described as the less-than-human living conditions in Gaza will make the Palestinian enclave potentially uninhabitable by 2020. That warning comes from the UN Trade and Development Agency, UNCTAD, in its report into the Palestinian economy. In addition to the severe crises linked to water and electricity shortages, the UN agency said that Gaza's 1.8 million residents have yet to recover from the destruction of last year's attacks by Israel. Deanne Penn filed this report.
Three wars in 6 years and 8 years of economic blockade have been blamed for terrible living conditions in the occupied Palestinian territory, the UN Trade and Development Agency UNCTAD said Tuesday. In its latest report on Gaza and the West Bank, UNCTAD experts warn that development is not merely hindered, but reversed. In fact, the figures show that for the first time since 2006, the Palestinian economy has gone into recession. The conflict in 2014 was particularly damaging, with whole areas of Gaza still flattened by attacks, so says UNCTAD's Mahmoud El-Khafif.
The fact that electricity is not enough, the fact that a number of hospitals had been destructed, the fact is that there is no drinking water enough, it's just for any rational human being would be able to deduct what's going to happen. I mean, we had a study before the destruction of 2014 indicating that Gaza won't be livable in 2020. It's not that things have stayed as they were in 2012, but they got much, much worse in 2014.
Israel is criticized for withholding almost $700 million of import tax revenue from the Palestinian authorities in the first 4 months of the year. According to the UN agency, it's the sixth time Israel has withheld the money since 1997, which are far and away the main source of public revenue in the West Bank and Gaza. In another sign of the deteriorating conditions on the ground, UNCTAD said that in the year 2000, 72,000 people depended on food aid, but now that number has risen to almost a million. And in Gaza, unemployment is as high as 80%, the UN agency added. Deanne Penn, United Nations.
As we reported earlier, deadly clashes erupted outside the parliament building in Kiev, Ukraine, Monday, between police and crowds of protesters who oppose amendments to the Constitution providing for the decentralization of the country, particularly the breakaway eastern provinces. Washington applauded the Kiev government for using police to put an end to the violence. That was not their line during the Maidan protests, when masses of protesters throwing Molotov cocktails and shooting at police drove the elected president from the country in fear of his family's lives. This was then State Department spokesperson Marie Harf during the Maidan protests.
We will continue to consider additional steps, as I said, including sanctions, in response to the use of violence. We continue to urge President Yanukovych and his government to protect the democratic rights of all Ukrainians, including the right to peaceful protest. And if we have to take additional steps, we will.
Ortiz Gayan-Chichikayan tried to get an explanation from U.S. State Department spokesperson Mark Toner Monday.
2 years ago, the message that came from the U.S. was more clear and less murky, and that it was to urge the government at the time not to use force, even though some of the same groups who came out to the parliament on Monday threw Molotov cocktails at the police and so on and so forth. Why should the approach to these nationalist groups be different now as opposed to 2 years ago?
You know, I think we can all agree that the Maidan was largely a people-led, peaceful demonstration, remarkably so, given the months and months that many of the people were out in the Maidan. Our message is that if you want to peacefully protest, and let me finish, peacefully protest, then the obligation on the part of law enforcement is that they should respect that right.
2 years ago, are you saying that it was all peaceful? Was there
I said, you know, I can't speak to every incident that took place on the Maidan, but by and large, yes, it was a dignified, peaceful protest on behalf of the Ukrainian people.
Did you see footage
in the back,
of
please?
I answered the question.
Please go ahead.
I answered the question.
Analyst Roger Annis, editor of the New Cold War, speaking with RT Monday, explained why the State Department spokesperson was being, at a minimum, disingenuous in his response.
In fact, there's a growing body of evidence that researchers into the events on Maidan Square are showing that there was extreme violence practiced by the right-wing forces that were driving to overthrow the elected president at the time, and specifically the use of sniper fire on February 20th. There's now considerable evidence, including in the official investigation ongoing in Ukraine itself, that the sniper fire that was blamed on the police of the government that was overthrown, in fact, came from the right-wing side. And so, that the right-wing side practices violence is no mystery to anyone, but perhaps these latest events in Kyiv will give more impetus to a real and serious investigation into the violent, extremely violent events on Maidan Square on February 20th and in the days and weeks leading up to that.
Amid ongoing fighting in Yemen, the UN raised the alarm Tuesday over the steep rise in the number of civilian casualties and the deteriorating humanitarian situation there. In the southern city of Taiz, the Human Rights Office, OHCHR, said that 95 civilians had been killed in the past 2 weeks alone. The UN office said that 53 of those reportedly died as a result of airstrikes by Saudi Arabia. Daniel Johnson filed this report from the UN in Geneva.
Following a spike in civilian deaths in Yemen in recent weeks, the UN Human Rights Office, OHCHR, said that one city has seen nearly 100 civilians killed in just 2 weeks. That city is Taiz in the south of the country. There, more than half of the victims died from aerial bombardments directed by Saudi-led coalition forces at Houthi rebels, OHCHR said. All the while, the humanitarian situation is as dire as ever in Yemen. Since the escalation of the armed conflict on the 26th of March, OHCHR has documented more than 2,100 civilian deaths, though the actual numbers are believed to be much higher. Daniel Johnson, United Nations, Geneva.
Monday saw the outgoing president of the UN Security Council, Nigeria's permanent representative, Ambassador Uche Joy Agwu, close her August term with a summary of the council's work. This month, as heads of state from around the world gather at UN headquarters in New York for the opening session of this year's General Assembly, the Security Council presidency will fall to Russia's permanent representative, Vitaly Churkin. He outlined some of the challenges before the council, particularly in the Middle East and North Africa, where he noted conflicts have created a mass migration of refugees.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We would like to thank Ambassador Joy Agwu and the whole of the Nigerian delegation for the skillful leadership of the Security Council in August. We commend the work of the New Zealand presidency in June. We would like to endorse the condolences with the death of the Brazilian force commander. Madam President, this month we worked quite well. We paid a lot of attention to the Middle East and North Africa. The situation there, unfortunately, leaves a lot to be desired. The region is in a zone of instability, conflicts are ubiquitous and bloody, and the prospects for them being resolved looks doubtful. In August, we, as is our custom, talked about the situation in the Palestinian-Israeli conflict. The lack of resolution there maintains a risk of growth of tension and radicalization. Uncertainty regarding the Gaza Strip is worsened by a lack of intra-Palestinian unity. Unfortunately, the situation in Libya remains very serious. As a gross violation of the Security Council resolutions of the Security Council by members of the Council, these violations are having a significant impact, and there are new tragedies. There's now a wave of migrants who are trying to leave the chaos of Libya to get to the shores of Europe. Despite the cautious optimism that the Special Representative of the Secretary General, Bernardino Leon, talked about regarding the prospects of work on the political agreement, there are lots of causes for concern. At the moment, the state is continuing to fall apart, and this is used by terrorist organizations, including ISIS. They are continuing to expand their presence in Libya. We discussed in detail Yemen, where armed challenges are underway, and armed clashes rather underway, and the humanitarian situation is serious. Practically every day, civilians die. According to a report, yesterday, the airstrikes killed about 13 civilians. There is no light at the end of the tunnel as yet. We are decisively in favour of a swift end to the bloodshed. We would urge parties to display a constructive spirit at the negotiations under the aegis of the envoy Ismail Ahmed. An important place in the work of the Council is Syria. We are pleased that we managed to adopt a number of important documents, including the PRST on Syria, urging Syrians to swiftly include in the diplomatic efforts, swiftly involved in the diplomatic efforts of the special envoy Staffan de Mistura. On the 7th of August, we adopted Resolution 2235 that set up the joint investigative mechanism of Syria. This, as we hope, will work professionally and impartially. This is particularly important given the fact that, as we have seen work on this in the Security Council, some members of the Security Council are prepared to ignore terrorists just in pursuing their own political aims. We have to say that there are a number of ISIS fighters using chemical agents and toxic substances such as chlorine and mustard gas. There are reports saying that ISIS has achieved access to technological documentation and involved foreign specialists in working on toxic substances in the areas and territory that they have captured. The threats coming from ISIS are absolutely huge in magnitude. Over recent days, with the adoption of 2235 and the joint mechanism, we have had information that chemical weapons are being used by ISIS in neighbouring Iraq, and we cannot ignore these cases. This is very dangerous to do so. In this regard, the Russian delegation considers that the Security Council must adopt a resolution that would expand the mandate of this mechanism to Iraq, and we are starting the appropriate work on this. We're convinced that the adoption of such a resolution is urgent. However, it would just be a small stone in the greater edifice. It would encourage, it would put a range of Middle Eastern and North African countries, would hope to protect them from the threat. The ISIS fighters are trying to get their quasi-state across the whole of the territory. There is a time now for a comprehensive analysis of the nature of the conflicts in the Middle East and North Africa and the need for the collective work under the UN Charter. We need to find common denominators and have a general understanding both of the reasons for the crisis in the Middle East and North African region and also the reasons for the political factors behind this. The international community has to have the Security Council playing a key role, and then it can agree upon measures to curb the growth of the conflict potential in the area. On the 30th of September, we're planning to hold an open session at the ministerial level on the maintenance of peace and security, the resolution of conflict in the Middle East and Northern Africa. Following that, we're planning to have a PRST, which would focus on the urgency of measures to resolve and bring an end to conflicts in the Middle East and North Africa, and also would reflect possible steps to end the terrorist risk in the region. We are banking on broad involvement and support by member states of the UN. We are convinced that the pertinence of this has been confirmed by the work of the Council in August, when we tried to solve very slowly the Middle Eastern problem. This experience has shown that it is only possible to improve the region using a comprehensive approach, firmly rooted in international law and based on the prerogatives of the Security Council of the UN. In conclusion, Madam, I'd like to express my gratitude to all members of the Security Council who expressed their support for the upcoming Russian presidency in September. Thank you.
The issue of the refugees was the topic of our conversation with our analysts, Professor Mark Sloboda, Senior Lecturer in International Relations at Moscow State University, and Eric Dreitzer, geopolitical analyst based in New York City, founder of StopImperialism.com. We spoke with them via Skype Saturday. It appears that the refugee crisis is a byproduct, or, an accident of policy, or, an unintended consequence. And I'm wondering, You know, Gaddafi warned that precisely this would happen if they destabilized
Libya. Yes, he did. He very specifically warned that refugees would be flowing across. Yes.
And I'm wondering, you know, certainly there were people at Langley and elsewhere, if Gaddafi could figure it out, that were also at least measuring it and considering the possibility. Is it possible that this is not an accident, that they fully knew that this would happen and did it for some specific purpose that's yet unknown to us, Mark? I mean, I'm sorry.
Let Eric jump in there.
Eric, I mean.
Oh, well, now you got my conspiracy gears going full tilt. I 100% do agree. Well, let me back away from saying 100%. I think that there's a very real policy. There's a very real probability that there are some who saw this potential. Now, I don't think that that's a primary motivation for destroying Libya or for destroying Syria. I think that they have very clear geopolitical imperatives and strategic imperatives for doing that that have nothing to do with this. Let's say that
some people thought of it just as a win-win. You know, this is a consequence and that's good. Why would they do that? What would be the benefit?
What's the win side for them?
The win for them is that it weakens any potential European independence. It weakens any ability for Europe to be able to actually break free to some degree of the United States, because the more disunited European society is, the more that it fractures, the more that you see these tensions within each country, the easier Europe is to dominate for the United States and for the empire, broadly speaking. And I think that there are some in Brussels who are very fearful of any true, let's call it national or international unity within Europe. And I think that the flow of refugees, the flow of these victims of imperialism, makes it all that much more difficult for European countries to unite, for those societies within each country individually to stay united, because they understand exactly what Mark was talking about earlier. They understand that the refugees coming into the country create an internal contradiction between the political correctness of liberalism, of bourgeois liberalism, or whatever you want to call it, and this, you know, this nationalistic tendency, which is both on the left and especially prominent on the right. And that sort of contradiction is something that imperialists and strategic planners would very much like to exacerbate and to highlight for the purposes of being able to control Europe. There's a very real fear. Look, bottom line is this. Remember that Russia's entire goal, its framework for the first, let's say, 14 years from 2000 to 2014 was always that they wanted to move closer to Europe, that they wanted a more united continent where Russia and Europe could sit at the table together as equals, blah, 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 all of that, right? Well, the United States is tremendously fearful that Europe would gain a degree of independence and would be able to do precisely that. That's part of the reason why they foment war in Ukraine. That's part of the reason why they put more and more troops into Eastern Europe, NATO troops into Poland, into the Baltic states, etc. It is to continue to create that divide between Russia and Europe. Simultaneously, they would like to create divides within Europe, and the refugee crisis is a very good way to do that. Now, again, I stress, I am not suggesting that was a primary motivation for any of these wars, but certainly I think it is a positive outgrowth from the perspective of imperialists.
Yeah, okay, I'm going to defer there completely if I can, and say that this refugee crisis was an expected but at best ignored backlash. And, you know, an inevitable backlash, but something that was ignored rather than seen as a win-win situation. And I'll disagree with you there, because while Russia could very much, who isn't a factor in this, could very much see benefit of that. And as many people point out, Russia is connecting with people on both the alternative and even some fringe contact, if not through the government, of the far right or the far left, like Syriza, with Russia. So they are very much, and the breakdown individually with energy negotiations state by state rather than wanting to deal with Europe as a whole. Russia is very much interested in EU disunity. It is to their benefit to see independent sovereign states in Europe. The United States, on the other hand, whose primary agent of influence in Europe is NATO, is very much interested in a unitary European concept. They find that they are much able to exert imperial control over Europe through a Brussels-centric unified European political elite that shares their own version of European exceptionalism, an idea that this postmodern liberal society is the pinnacle and should be spread to the rest of the world, rather than independent sovereign nations, which they find rather messy, inefficient, and so on. So I'm going to disagree. This is actually a bad thing. The United States would not want to see.
But we're not talking about it. I'm not talking about independent sovereign nations. I'm talking about fractured nations. I'm talking about nations that are in constant turmoil, where the United States is able to exert influence, where it's able to back the right horse and to put down the wrong horse, when it's able to destroy a government easily when that government turns away from it, where the United States is able to look, the bottom line is this, that, as you said, and I agree with you, U.S. interest is NATO, U.S. interest is military, but at the same time, the United States is about influence and the various ways in which it can do that. I don't think it's one or the other. I don't think that the United States desperately needs to have Europe perfectly united, nor do I think that the United States wants to see Europe completely dissolved either. I think that they would like to create turmoil as much as they can in order to be able to exacerbate a lot of these internal contradictions. So if Le Pen were to rise to power in France, that would probably be considered a loss for the United States, especially if she were to follow through with some of those anti-NATO positions. On the other hand, the United States is able to continue to exert control over Europe, partially because of the economic decline of Europe, and they understand that the further this goes within the context of this capitalist crisis that Europe has been facing, the refugee crisis only exacerbates that further. The decline of the euro strengthens the dollar. There's a lot of these internal contradictions here. The further down the euro goes, the better it is for Wall Street. So, you know, while I agree with you on the one hand, I think that it's sort of a, let's call it a multi-vector policy that the United States employs.
Okay, Mark, go ahead, take 30 seconds on that, and then let's move on.
Yeah, let's just move on. I think I said what I wanted to.
Okay.
There.
Right.
Any further would require a paper to go into. I disagree. I still think the U.S. is primarily interested in not having these types of divisions in Europe, and then they look to the elite. But let's change the subject. It would get far too technical at this point.
I think it would be good. Take 3 minutes each to do essentially a closing statement, a summary.
A summary of this wandering conversation?
Yeah, well, of your picture of the world at the moment. That'd make it easy.
3 minutes, Jesus. Mark, me?
Oh, Mark first. Mark went first.
Mark first. Okay, all right. Where is the world at this point? The world is very much on the brink. We are seeing brinkmanship. We are seeing saber rattling between the West and Russia, and between the United States and its allies and China in the South China Sea now, to an almost unprecedented degree. You know, certainly for decades, and maybe not going back until the Cuban Missile Crisis. The number of Russian and NATO military exercises that are happening face to face with large conventional forces that are being, that very much hate and fear each other now across state lines and dealing in international waters, international airspace, confronting each other, where mistakes and misunderstandings could very easily lead to war. This should alarm everyone. I mean, we've become very accustomed, I think, over the course of this last 20 or so years, maybe even 30, to think that the specter of World War III, that is of nuclear war, of great power confrontation, is gone. And we start thinking of terrorism and economics. And, of course, we haven't even touched on environmentalism today, which may be, with climate change, a greater threat than everything. But that's for another day. But we've seen all of that come back in a flash. And why we have seen that come back in a flash, I think, is because of a U.S.-led Western hegemony that is lashing out at what it sees as its declining power in the world. It knows that it has a very limited closing window of removing obstacles to its hegemonic zone of control. Syria and Ukraine are, you know, and Libya are the tail ends of this that it thought it could bring in. You know, President Putin in Russia was fully prepared to leave office permanently, to turn on after what happened in Libya, when Russia under Medvedev acquiesced to a UN Security Council resolution, and then saw it abused and turned into regime change. Putin said, all right, we can't deal with these people. Whether it's a Democrat or a Republican, they are set in remaking the world according to their own geopolitical interests. And we know that we will be on this slate probably sooner rather than later. If they don't come for us, then they will certainly be against governments like Belarus, Kazakhstan, in our near abroad, which are, and Ukraine, which are red line security interests for us, and in which we have large populations that very much identity wise are connected to us and look to us for protection and cultural direction. It is this confrontation. It is a lashing out, a dying, fading hegemon that is fading due to its own internal contradictions with the neoliberal global capitalist architecture it has created. Capital flows leaving the West, going east, going to China, allowing for a rebirth of Russia. We're at an extremely dangerous geopolitical moment at this point. And it all boils down to these, thin lines in Ukraine between fascists and, what it must be said, many pro-Russian, be they Ukrainian or Russian, but nationalists or, imperialists on one side of a line, paramilitaries facing off with each other with large military conventional forces right behind them, or in the South China Sea with the construction of these islands and great navies facing off. We're at a really dangerous point in world history, I think.
Eric?
Yeah, I would agree with that. You know, I'm reminded of the famous Chinese literary work, perhaps one of the most famous in China's modern history, The Romance of the Three Kingdoms. And the first lines of that in the English translation are really powerful. Empires wax and wane, states cleave asunder and coalesce. And I think that process is, I think, in many ways, the process of history. And it is something that people have known for centuries. And I think the waxing and waning of empires is something that has continued on throughout human history. And we are now seeing the waning of an empire, of a globally dominant, perhaps the first truly globally dominant empire. And the question is, how does that empire actually attempt to prevent its own collapse? There are many ways in which that happens. If you look at the Roman Empire, that collapse happened over a number of centuries, and it was a decline, but not necessarily an overnight collapse. And I think that the United States and the imperial system that it is at the head of, I think they understand that the waning of this empire needs to be extended over a long period of time. That means what they call having a new American century, essentially allowing the empire to continue to function for as long as it possibly can. That is ultimately their goal. And I think that is really the goal that they're pursuing all over the the world. If you look at what the United States and its allies are doing in Central Asia with Afghanistan, with the former Soviet republics, if you look what they're doing in the Middle East, trying to break the alliances that have developed between Iran and Syria and Hezbollah, if you look at what they're doing in North Africa or in Central Africa, Latin America should be included there as well. I mean, you have these U.S. and Western-funded opposition movements that have developed in these countries primarily because Ecuador and Venezuela and Bolivia and Nicaragua have not only moved closer together, but they have forged ties with China, they have forged ties with Russia, even with Iran. And you've seen that these countries, which have traditionally been the so-called U.S. imperial backyard, are no longer tied to the backyard, to the fence post, as they once were.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.